The following tape represents 10 years of collecting research and intimate interviews with members of the Grateful Dead and the San Francisco rock and roll community. The first interview is between myself and Pigpen.
No big important thing that if somebody's going over here, somebody's going there, all that stuff.
Yeah, well, it is now. To me, from the writing point of view, you know, to get it all together.
Yeah.
And once I get it all together and chronicle it,
then you gotta sort it out.
That's exactly. Good luck.
Of course, you realize that everything I've told you is a lie.
Yeah, pretty much. But my book will be an even compounded lie.
Yeah, the thing is, but the difference between your book and Tom Wolfe's book, for instance, is that you know us personally.
Well, that's what we're hoping for. That's what the Rolling Stone goes for, you know.
Tom Wolfe don't know us. I mean, I met him, you know, I talked to him, you know, that kind of business. That's cool. I got nothing against
him. Tom Wolfe goes.
In fact, he's a nice cat.
Really? He's a real nice cat.
The thing is that he hasn't lived with everybody that you're thinking about writing about. And you have?
Oh, almost everybody.
Almost.
For instance?
Well, you've lived and talked to me.
That's
quite
enough.
A few years.
That's enough.
And you're tight with Jerry and Phil and, you know, everybody. And it's sort of, I think what it ought to be is like sort of an overall conglomerate of the lifestyles and situations of all the people in our family.
Yeah.
I don't think you should dwell too heavily on details.
No, I'm not.
I've got to
get the details down so I can pick what I want.
Yeah, but I don't think you should dwell too heavily on details like dates or years or names or places.
Not too heavily, but I've got to get that all in my head.
Yeah, right.
See, for the chronology of it. It's like the overlapping ellipses of years.
If you want dates, details, and stuff, talk to Phil.
Phil's one of my last people. Phil is virtually as petrified as a tape recorder. Do you know he's never been interviewed?
Oh, bullshit.
No, Phil has never been seriously interviewed. Like in print. You know, about music, for instance. And that kind of stuff is difficult to get out of Phil. He and I took a psilocybin trip this last weekend, you know, the first one in 5 years.
It seems like
I had a good hit, but still couldn't get it put in a tape. When I get it all together, Phil promises me that he'll sit down and talk to me and get all the dates and facts and names down so that we can
have. Well, that's good, because my dates and facts and names are.
But even that, like you say, but I agree with you, it's totally secondary. The important thing is the style and the capture of the imagery of the Star of Fears, the starvation trips, Paul Spiegel's tragedy, the joys, the sorrows, that kind of, I mean, it sounds like cliche, but, you know, the ups and the downs of it. And,
well, yeah, but the ups and the downs of it were there, and still are. And so, rather than making a documented history of each of our progressions,
yeah.
It's not just the Grateful Dead, it's not just
Warlocks,
it's not just the Zodiacs.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just Mother McCree's. It's the whole thing on the way it, like, came together.
Right.
It's a lot smoother and has a lot less hard edges.
I'm hoping that it will blend in all together like a big balloon or bubble. some kind eventually. But right now I'm trying to gather facts in the most scientific and almost boring way I can, so that when I can put them on tape and get them back on.
I eventually got the interview with Phil. Of course, I've known him for 20 years. And I had to move in with him for 2.5 years between 1970 and 72.5 to get the interview. But it was worth it. I think we both learned a lot.
Myself there, and John Lear used to come by every day and bring me a dollar. He hustled up a dollar or $2. What he'd do, he'd hustle up $2, one for him and one for me, and I'd eat. I'd get to eat because he'd hustle up a dollar. I was mostly sitting there trying to write music and.
And he was throwing dollars.
Yeah, yeah. So that lasted till about June 60, and then me and John went to Seattle and Spokane, hitchhiked up there trying to get to Calgary, where he knew a guy who we maybe get jobs in the oil fields or some shit like that. Of course, it was really impossible.
On the road.
Yeah, on the road. That was where I had my freight train experience, man.
A mystical thing beyond, just to keep you going.
Exactly.
It'll never happen.
Just to get away from it.
No, it's not true.
No, because it was really bad, man, because I'd blown it at college, man. I didn't study nothing but music at college, and I wasn't interested in graduating from college or no fucking thing.
Yeah.
And my folks came down to San Mateo, and they gave me a whole bunch of shit. My dad made me shave off my mustache and all that shit.
Is that right? Yeah, I remember that vaguely.
Yeah, me and John just invented this scam on the spur of the moment just to get out from under, you know. Well, it didn't work, but it was a great experience. It was a great experience, man.
What was the experience?
Well, the experience of being on the road with your buddy.
Yeah.
And being pretty much completely self-sufficient, you know.
Yeah.
And meeting all kinds of far out people on the road, you know.
Like who?
Oh, we met the Greyhound racing guys, you know, who gave us we made it all the way from San Francisco to Seattle in 22 hours hitchhiking, which is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And they gave us all a ride all the way from the Woodland turnoff to Yakima, Washington. Which is all the way through Washington, through Oregon, halfway through California and Washington. So, and they ran down a whole Greyhound racing scam to us, and it was good old boys on the road time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was 20 years old, man, and he'd been up.
Yeah, yeah.
But after a while, it got pretty funky, you know.
Sure, it does.
And so the best part was when we came back, we couldn't get anywhere from Spokane into Canada. There was no way. So we decided to come back to Seattle, see if we could get going to Seattle. So, my folks knew some people in Seattle, so the best part was when we hopped the freight from Spokane to Seattle, man. That was the most magical part. It took us about one day, is all. We really, like, got on the train early in the morning.
Yeah.
We were like 4:30, something like that, before the sun.
No cares, really. Just sit there until the train
goes. Well, right. See, the thing about it is, the Great Northern, man, there's a policy on the Great Northern. The
guy,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right, the guy who built the Great Northern, he said, they built it, let them ride. And so it's one of the greatest hobo jungle numbers.
Oh, I see.
In the whole country, man.
Ah.
It's just a classic one. Peterson can tell you about it.
Yeah.
It goes to Chicago, but he went through it in the winter, so it wasn't his boss. This was in the middle of summer, man. And that country up there is fucking incredible. And we got to see all the back parts of it. Going out of Spokane, man, the railroad curves around the bluff. Spokane's built on a bluff, and there's a great big river below it. And the railroad goes out on the other side of the river, so you get to see the whole panorama of the river.
It's pretty transcendent.
Incredibly so, man. I got very high during that train ride.
And there wasn't any grass around, really, for speed or anything?
Mm-mm. I had smoked grass the first time, I think, that year at Catalpa Street.
But you didn't carry any with you?
No, man, there wasn't any, man. We spent $10 for 8 joints, man.
$0.80 a joint.
Bobby Peterson and Ken Hayes and myself.
And it wasn't that good grass either.
It got me high, though.
Yeah.
It got me high. Those fuckers got me high. They left me high. They got me high and left me there with my records. They knew just what to do, Bobby Peterson knew just what to do.
Yeah, he's a strange cat. I wish he still knew it.
Didn't work with John Lear. John Lear didn't get high.
Yeah, what's the matter, man? That must be a horrible disappointment. The fact the guy is a car repossessor now. And into it.
Yeah, well, he was into speed breaking.
Oh, yeah.
That's a whole long other story. Bad.
Hear that, folks out there? Speed!
Yeah, he rotted his mind pretty bad with it for a while. But that's a whole other story.
Tom Constantin was Phil Lesh's closest musical companion from 1961 to 1967, when Tom left the band. Even after that time, Tom and Phil stayed in close touch. TC eventually wound up teaching in Rochester, New York, and touring the world playing his increasingly interesting music. Here's what T.C. has to say about his early associations with the dead.
One of the magical things about music is that you seem to create something that is, it exists in this supernatural space that is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. But like it can be so subtle.
Here we are. Edit out my part.
About okay, no, it was supernatural space being, wasn't that what Mahler, Ives, Scriabin, Obrecht, okay. Bach,
Henry Kiesack?
Well, whoever, you name it, you know what about.
Sure, well, like the idea of the great books of the Western world presents these monuments of literature as being part of a great conversation, like an ongoing stream of consciousness of the collective unconscious.
Exactly.
That you're tuning in on and participating on.
But music can be written that isn't into the Akashic Records. Music can be written that is just sort of bebop and to somehow doesn't register on the higher level consciousness.
Right.
And then there's music that attains to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So were you attaining, do you feel like that's one of the striving
well,
that
they'd written? Variable thing. Like it was definitely a thing to be striven for.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always attained. There were so many different elements. Like then there would be nights when one member of the band would get off and another wouldn't.
Or two and about three.
Different biorhythms. And there were times when I got off. In fact, there were a couple of times. Yeah, well, it was difficult when you're underamplified and you know that somebody isn't going to like what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Once at the
start, is that a supportive thing?
Oh, no. Towards the end, I had as much job security as a Jewish stormtrooper. A couple of times at the Fillmore East, especially during Dark Star. And once at the gig at the Sacramento Fairgrounds, I remember it was rather nice.
Get off on that, huh?
Yeah. There's a certain smoothness of entering the flow. I have bad nights and, you know, good nights and shows of all sorts since then. Performers are like the moon, you know.
Yeah, phases.
I'll be trying not
nodes.
You try not to moon the audience.
You have a node, a code in your node.
Oh, that's very cryptic.
We got one in. But, I mean, Phil said it influenced was Mahler, Ives, Scriabin, Satie, people like that.
Some of those names I would concur on. Mahler, Phil and I kind of, I think, discovered around the same time and together.
Mm-hmm.
Like at one time when we were sharing a house on Eureka Street in
the city, I think I had every published recording of Mahler's Ninth Symphony compared to them.
There were all kinds of people that gave us an early perspective on the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane in the early Palo Alto days. Here's Paul Foster, one of the chief and original Merry Pranksters.
Oh, we got to the offstage, huh? Okay, this night, this we have to come up to. These guys are trying to make a commercial thing go. Okay, there's mainly two groups. There's the San Jose group and there's the Palo Alto group. Now, there's interchange between them, but there's mainly those two. The San Jose group included Pigpen only because I could he could get it. Only because he needed the dough.
Yeah.
Okay? I paid him 15 a night. And it was groovy. I was getting a good deal. I was getting a very good deal. This chick, Biddy, she would take care of getting on stage, you see. And it was cool. And then he'd play his set, which was when people had calmed down a bit, okay?
Yeah.
And it was groovy, and we put the lights low, because he didn't like to get up on the stage.
He's straight shot, right.
He's better at it,
though. See, it's taken him 3 years to do a solo now. He gets up, does a little solo number.
Yeah. I recall, too, when he jumped on the, he jumped in the car with us to go get the acid test for us had been stolen. And looked down
stolen?
Yeah, by Babs and
Babs
and some of these guys. The sort of inner core maybe if there was one of the pranksters, the, let's say, the people that Gretchen could afford to turn on, maybe. The ones that she found agreeable. Came down to that problem. Anyway, they stole this bus and went off to San Diego, and we wanted to go and get it, and we wanted some help. And I knew Big Ben would go if we said we're going to drink wine. And we did. We drank wine all the way there, and we completely fouled up the coup of taking back the bus. We found it. Yeah, but we couldn't pull it off. They found out about us before we could get it off the ground. Anyway, they had changed the wiring, the ignition under the dashboard, you know.
Was that a for real thing or is it a prank?
Oh, it was for real. Well, prank or prank? Their pranks were for real? What do you mean? I don't know. Pardon me. I don't know. Anyway, so we didn't he gave us good news all the way. The dead, you know, kept a separate house in L.A. during that test. And if you wanted to get really high, you went over there. Because Osley was usually there with his DMT.
DMT, yeah, weird shit.
And I'd run up and down the stairs like a mad, distinct calliope.
Yeah.
After he'd give me that cut.
Yeah, really low jeopardy.
Page Browning of the Prince.
Yes, I know
Page. There. He would go over there with me. For the same purpose, we both dug DMT a lot.
Yeah.
And we knew we could get it there.
But you'd smoke it.
Yeah. Smoke it, yeah, he'd shoot it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I knew how to smoke so much that I couldn't complete a tour. I know how to smoke. No, there's a way to smoke DMT. Once you learn how,
yeah.
If it's good DMT, you can't complete one tour.
Yeah, right.
Because there's nobody there to complete it.
Yeah, nobody's there. Right. Yeah, right. You're gone, yeah.
Nobody
there to complete that.
Yeah,
but you gotta watch out, your
matches
goes out.
Yeah, well, or the outfit don't just dangle out of your arms.
Yeah.
I never do shoot for putting some high inspector up in your arms.
For the tape's sake.
No, I never. Once I shot some speed just to see how it was, and it didn't really show me anything. I didn't see all this.
Yeah.
I waved it if I would. A side,
yeah, I feel so
way last night. Anyway, let's see. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Let's better start chronologically. I got interested in this offstage.
Yeah.
I also got interested in this girl, B.
Right.
Who was a friend of a cousin of a guy who worked with me. I'm a programmer now.
Yeah.
I'm a computer programmer.
Don't you do it now?
This is the beginning of 64. Let's
see. What are you doing right now?
I'm working as a common laborer with a dolly and a hand truck.
Oh, actually, an uncommon laborer.
Yes. Warehouse.
With French cuffs.
Yeah, I wore this to work with a sweater over it.
Yeah,
right. Anyway. Sure, I come on just like what they want. I know what they want. Somebody who starts working and doesn't stop until he's, you know, until you're okay.
Yeah.
Okay, it's easy.
If you couldn't understand everything that Paul said, never fear. Paul not only stuttered and stammered, but he was a student and disciple of Neil Cassady. Neil ended most of his paragraphs with a kind of three-line psychobabble. But Mike Ferguson, at the same time the acid tests were going on, was busily working in Virginia City at the Red Dog Saloon, setting up the Charlatans, the really first organized performing rock band in San Francisco. Ferguson I've known for approximately 20 years. He died in February of 1979. This is an interview that he and I had discussing the great old-fashioned dope dealer, Goldfinger.
likes to be Mr. Big.
Well, he's only got one hand, you know.
Yeah, I know. I was going to design my hand. I really was.
Well, Goldfinger was an expatriate.
For being an expatriate. I'm all for it. You know?
Yeah, I am too. The number of places keeps narrowing down that you could go for a retreat.
Where, for instance?
Oh, I would just imagine, like most places in Europe are pretty hot over Americans as such.
Yeah, only if you're a European-American, you see. And you don't know until you go whether you are or not, and it turns out you are. See, I mean, you know you are, really. I know you are, but I didn't know for sure if I could relate, because
I always like David Niven, you know.
David Niven. No, I'm talking about lifestyle.
Nice trip. Gives me a nice feeling over there. And you're not trying to burn me. Those fuckers are they just don't understand.
What happened to you in Mexico when you went down? That's a very blank period. I don't know much about what happened to
you. Which time? I went 3 times, actually.
Yeah, you had a fascination for Mexico.
Yeah. I went last year, or a little over a year ago.
No, I mean back in the...
Yeah,
when you dropped out from...
Yeah, that's when I left from here. I'd never turned on or anything before, so I wasn't turning on to grass or anything even when I went down there the first time. That was miserable. Went with that guy Lance from the sandal shop. I don't know if you remember him. Raised.
Yeah.
That guy. He used to beat his old lady up all the time. Well, the four of us just took off one night in a mad flame.
Yeah. I thought that's how you disappeared.
I used to go with that chick Loxie. I don't know if you remember her.
The working man's dead thing is nice.
Yeah, that's tasty.
Yeah. Because the smokestacks in the back are all penciled.
Yeah,
they're
right. This thing, you probably would dig this thing that we're doing for the new riders.
I really like to see what you have.
I don't have anything right now. I just got, well, it all stems on the actual putting together of the thing with the photographs, which he hasn't taken yet.
Well, no, but you know, the truth is they haven't got a contract yet, so what they're trying to do is put together a presentation package.
Yeah, it's a comp. That's what it's for.
Okay.
It's going to be like when the album's folded over.
I can talk to Marmaduke about it. I think nobody's talked to Marmaduke.
Yeah?
Yeah,
well,
I can liaise
talked to him about it.
Yeah,
maybe,
I know, but can I explain? Cosmic Cat. Do you still have any of those old drawings?
No. Those weren't my idea anyway. Those were Ed Turner. Do you remember Ed Turner?
No.
Yeah, he used to work at Coffee and Confusion in the kitchen.
Tall, thin guy?
No, he's a little spade cap. Little tiny guy. He's now working with some offshoot of the committee. But he always wanted to be a cartoonist.
But you did the Cosmic Cat cartoon.
Yeah, right. We used his ideas. You know? And we sort of did a little strip that we didn't publish or anything.
But some of it was your ideas, too, I know.
Oh, yeah. Well, naturally, you know, there was an intermingling of ideas.
You don't have those. He has those, I will say.
God, who knows what happened. I thought you saved
everything. I was so happy to see all the Art Nouveau because I figured you were a great collector of old
memorabilia. I do save some things. A lot of things I regret having given away, especially drawings and art and stuff.
Oh, I could use some of those for the book too, man.
Yeah. We did a strip at the same time called Surplus.
Yeah.
It was a knight.
Yes,
a knight.
I remember
all
that.
Weird characters in there, Muggles, the magician.
Yeah, no, I didn't, but you know, you should resurrect some of those ideas too.
Well, I could probably.
Cartoons are coming in.
Liv Turner.
Locomotive to California Hall dances. That's
George.
Usually
awesome. Oh, not George, huh? He didn't promote them. It was usually each dance was promoted by somebody different, forming some little group.
The family hall sort of sprung out, the family dog sort of sprung out of the California Hall manipulations, right?
Well, the family dog started up actually while we were still up in Nevada. I mean, the idea of
it. The idea of it, yeah. They came down to the interim where the warlocks were. What
they probably
did. The warlocks.
That was Luria.
Yeah.
And Ellen, the chick on the wall in there.
Did you ever meet Paul Foster?
I'm not sure.
The Merry Prankster?
Mm-mm.
The guy with the... Did you see Woodstock?
Mm-mm.
Did you ever go out to any of the acid
tasters? They came up to Virginia City on the night, the same night that we were all packed and ready to leave after being there for 4 months.
Appropriate time to come.
God, yeah, it was very strange. It was about the same hour they arrived in town in this incredible bus, you know.
Yeah.
And it looked so far out in that.
And do you know who was on that bus when they went up that way?
God, I don't know.
Virginia Good.
Was she on that bus, really?
She
remembers that she told me, she went up there, she says, you know what, Ick? We went up to Virginia City, at that, and we that, remember Mike Ferguson was there. Yeah. I remember him, and she, I says, Jenny, you know, he doesn't even look the same. She, yeah, it's him, I heard him, saw he has a beard and all that, man.
Far out, yeah, we just kind of, it was too much.
Okay, I was driving, I'm digging this, man. I was driving her down to Boulder Creek on Skyline Boulevard, because her dad lives down in Boulder Creek. And there it was, over there in the corner, getting gas in La Honda.
No.
And she said, stop the car, stop the car. I said, what? Wow, there it is, man, the bus.
Mm-hmm. The bus.
The bus, man. Cling, cling. I says, what is this? And there's Roy Siebert. And I knew him from Palo Alto. So I went over there, and he was fixing a generator. And they were trying to get the show on the road, and there was a couch hanging over the back.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody used to sit on the couch, hanging out the back, and then the police, they didn't put the couch inside, because you couldn't have anybody hanging out the back.
No.
But the turret, you could live in the turret, it was okay to stay up there. And she said, I gotta go. And I said, man, these people are weird now, I'm telling you, you know, and she had just had a little bit of a nervous breakdown, one of her 19 or 20 nervous breakdowns, right?
Yeah.
And I said, now, Jenny, don't go on that bus, man. They'll blow your mind. But, you know, talk to them. But don't go very far. Like, go to Oakland with them or something. Get off and take a bus. No. I said, we got to take you down to see your dad, you know. Cool. No, I want to go. She was gone.
And that was the same trip?
That was the same trip. And she wound up seeing you in Virginia City at the end of it. They went up the Feather River. They followed the Feather River. Oh, yeah.
We just embarked on at that point on a trip.
Now, the synchronicity of this whole scene is almost divine. I mean, it's the probability of that kind of synchronicity happening that often with those kinds of people can only be explained by one hypothesis, that there were only about 1,000 of us.
God, I feel so important.
There were only about 1,000 people around here, you know, that were really turned on an inner level, you know. There was a lot of turned on people, but I mean, like, people that were really doing the number, you know. And all those people, it turns out, what I'm saying is they all got the same flash simultaneously, like a great electric cloud came down on a certain number of people and lifted off and sort of put a mark on so many people because they flashed on one thing, you know. Probably the Kennedy assassination is a big factor in it.
Next, we have a very brief interview with Gary Duncan of Quicksilver Messenger Service about the founding of Quicksilver, recorded in Honolulu, Hawaii. Bad acoustics, but Nicky Hopkins is playing piano in the background in the studio.
Then I got in the band at Greg Elmore's. Then we got really tight. And that band broke up, and we went to San Francisco. We were about 18.
Nicky Hopkins in the background.
Where were you from? Modesto, California. And he was from Merced. And we went to San Francisco and got turned on the LSD. We ran into Chip Rainer and Jimmy Murray right after our first acid trip. We were trying to start a band, but they weren't too sure about us. But they kept coming over and checking us out every couple of days. David was in a joint. As soon as David got out of the joint, we played together, and it was groovy. We were all Virgos. And up until then, I didn't know anything about that. Why did I know I was a Virgo? And then we just started playing together, you know.
So for the first San Francisco?
Yeah.
Were you involved in any specific club? Any specific house?
Yeah, me and Greg used to live in this chick's basement over by Fisherman's Wharf. It was terrible. From then, after we got together in the band, we moved over to Larkspur in this old house built up on some pilings out in the mud. We lived there through the winter.
Okay, that's the end of the tape, side one. This is a 60-minute cassette. Copyright Dead Archives, 1980.